Today we are looking at Syria. I was trying to think of what was the best way of looking at it. There are so many different aspects to it. But to me, the most interesting aspect at the moment is almost the confrontation of the great powers in the area. And when I say great powers, I'm looking at, obviously, Russia and the United States, Europe, but also Turkey and Iran. And I do think there are very dangerous flashpoints there. And we set the subject, which is a little bit stark: Syria, regional crisis, or New World War. New World War really came from remarks made by Mr. Medvedev, the Russian Prime Minister, earlier this year. They might be moving towards a Third World War. So I thought I'd set that as the context, but don't believe that's what we think is going to happen, but I hope it gives our panelists today the chance to expand a bit on their thoughts. We have a very high-powered panel. On my right, who I'm going to ask to speak first, we have Alistair Burt, who got into Parliament in 1983. He was, as you know, the Minister of State at the Department of Social Security. He's also been Minister of State at the Foreign Office, in charge of the Middle East, so he knows this subject very well. I could read out a very long set of facts about him, but I think that's probably enough for our purposes today, and I hope you'll forgive me for not saying more than that. I'm going to ask him to speak first. I'm going to ask Peter Oborne, who in a sense also needs no introduction, to follow him. He was the former chief political commentator of the Telegraph. He now writes in the Daily Mail. He has written some very strong views about what is happening in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and also in Syria, and I'm interested to hear his views today. On my left, I have the Right Honourable Tom Brake, who's the MP for Carshalton and Wallington. He is the Liberal Democrats Foreign Affairs spokesman, and so I think it's again important that we hear that voice today. And then finally, we have Dr. Christopher Phillips on my far left, who's a senior lecturer in the International Relations of the Middle East at Queen Mary University of London, and an associate fellow of the Middle East and North Africa programme. He's recently written a book, The Battle for Syria, International Rivalry in the Middle East, which is on sale at the back of the room, and if you'd like to buy one, I'm sure he'd be prepared to sign it for you at the end of this particular meeting. Without more ado, I need to ask Alistair Burt if he could lead off today's discussion. Thank you very much.
Your Excellencies, friends and colleagues, good afternoon. Thank you, Michael, very much for giving me this further opportunity to speak to the group, and I'm very appreciative of the chance to speak and to speak with some humility amongst those who know a very great deal about the subject, which is why I want to try and speak relatively briefly so that we get the opportunity to engage as we need to do. It's very hard to say anything new about the conflict in Syria, and it's very hard to say anything that doesn't sound trite from a distance of thousands of miles, bearing in mind what people are undergoing. I listened to David Knott, the surgeon, who was on Radio 4 this morning, and he described the situation in Aleppo and said that some of the doctors he was speaking to had said that they felt now they were a spectator sport, that as the world watched and could do nothing about it, he said, "Your friends are dying online." And that just emphasises the degree of awfulness with which Syria has sunk. It's our job to try and pull some strands out of this, and as always, to be looking as to what can be done. Because no matter how dreadful a situation is, the world has come through situations of great crisis and will do so again. I've thought through a series of challenges. Each have a bearing on just how far this could go and what could be the thread that could unravel and take this from, you know, the most wretched of regional conflicts, which now has a global reach, into potentially something much worse, and which each poses the opportunity to try and prevent that. Firstly, in terms of a series of challenges, which I won't dwell on, the scale of the humanitarian challenge. This is a humanitarian disaster locally, regionally and globally, to which no one has had the answer. The best answers have come from those locally, of course. In Europe, we worry about the number of people crossing the Mediterranean trying to get into Europe. It is as of nothing to those who are sheltered in the homes and in the communities of those of the neighbouring states, without whom this catastrophe would be so much worse. And to all those here who represent those states that are homing people, we owe you a huge debt of gratitude. But the scale of the displacement and the fact that people have worked out that instead of just staying in refugee camps forever, they can actually move and do something different has posed the challenge to the EU and the West that we've not yet been able to find the answer to. But in terms of the absolute horror that's going on at the moment, the challenge posed there, is there any prospect of relief? Is there anything that any of the international order institutions can do? Why is it that we're seeing mass murder perpetrated, we're afraid of making a challenge to those who are perpetrating it because we don't want to risk a confrontation while thousands die? It's come to a pretty pass when our responsibility to protect can be so easily brushed aside because of the risk of any confrontation and trying to save people's lives. Secondly, the institutional challenge and what this bodes for the future. Since 1945, we've carefully constructed a world order based on the ashes of the 20th century, the mid-20th century, which, despite all its problems and all its faults, and that everything complains about now, from Brexit to Trump to everything else, has built a world order which in the West has given people prosperity, safety, security, education, health and the like. Doesn't work as well as some people would like. Okay, that's fine. And how would we replace it? As far as international institutions are concerned, if the UN Security Council can't prevent a war on the scale of Syria, what's the point? And what's going to replace that? If the International Criminal Court now is not going to have the reach for justice as it did with Bosnia, so that those guilty of war crimes can now perpetrate them with impunity, what chance have we got in the future when people want to do still worse? Has R2P completely disappeared altogether? So it's a challenge to institutions. And if institutions are to be also consigned to the revision of history that we seem to be undergoing at the moment, what replaces them? And what chance is there of preventing a collapse into chaos and a threat of world war if they're not there? Thirdly, of course, it's a regional order challenge. The move of the United States to retrench its position, to look at its responsibilities around the world, to bring them in to some degree after Iraq and Afghanistan coincided with 2011, what happened afterwards, and of course with Syria. At the same time, it coincided with a determination to say to those states in the region, a number of whom extremely well armed over a long period of time, to say, you must take more responsibility for your own area. How have people met that challenge? Is that challenge going to be met in the future? Or can it be met with the United States having vacated its position in the belief and understanding that others would step up to the plate rather than leaving a vacuum into which Russia has stepped? Can regional powers work with themselves rather than needing an external partner? And because if they can't, nature abhorring a vacuum, if it's not filled by the United States, it will be filled by a revanchist Russia. And no one's quite got the answer to how far Russia wants to get involved in this and how far it's got other interests. And of course, the regional order also coincided with what was happening in relation to the Sunni-Shia issue and Saudi and Iran, and all that remains mixed up, as you all know, as well as me. And at just the time when a bit of stability might have been needed, that stability that the United States used to provide is no longer there. So it's a world order challenge, it's a regional order challenge, it's a humanitarian challenge. Also, in terms of looking ahead, of course, we've now got to factor in a new United States position. And I'm at a complete loss, as I'm sure most of us are. I do not know, none of us know, how the new administration in the United States is going to look upon its responsibilities. Though it seems very likely at present, it isn't going to wish to get re-engaged with the Middle East. I don't think that was the clarion call from those who voted for Donald Trump, for him to hear. And his present statements in relation to Russia and to Syria don't give much cause for hope. But we now have to factor in what the uncertainty of a Trump administration would do. And those of you who know this far better than me always know it's the uncertainty that produces the risk of conflict. If you do not know, if you cannot predict what others are going to do, you run the risk of miscalculation. And until we know more about the President-elect's views on the Middle East, on NATO, and what he really thinks can be done in Syria, then we remain in that difficult position. It's a challenge to our understanding of the order of terror. If people want to take the view that the only way to deal with ISIL is to confront it physically, as of course must be done, ISIL is a threat both to regional and world order, that we know. But to confront it without understanding the origin seems to me to be missing the point. To leave Assad alone after he's responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Sunnis and not recognise what sparked, to some degree, those who became more extreme in their defence of Sunnis and then took it on is missing the point. And for those who feel let down by the West and by others, what are they to make of a president who will not side with those who wanted democracy, a secular state, the opportunity for the things that many of us take for granted? What will they make of those who turn their back on them only to prosecute one fight against terror but miss some of its origins? So it's a challenge to the origins of terror and which path is going to be taken. And finally, it's a diplomatic challenge. Because if, after all that we've seen, we cannot find a path to diplomacy and a path to build on those who have been working patiently for several years, the opposition in Syria, other groups, the Track 2 work which is going on at the moment, if we cannot find a way to build on that work which is going on, then of course we run still greater risks. Ultimately, there is only a political solution. There is only a diplomatic solution. It looks very bleak at the moment. When I was in office, I was told the average length of conflict in the Middle East was 10 years. And I was told this when we were just getting started in Syria. After a year or so, it seemed bad. After 5 years, it seems dreadful. After 10 years, it's incalculable where it goes. But a series of uncertainties are posed around it in terms of United States response, the failure of international institutions. If this is not to end up in something more dramatic, then some of those challenges have gone to be met, and some of those who haven't stepped up to the plate in the past are going to have to find their way to do so. Thank you very much.
In the 8 minutes I have available, I'm going to take issue with everything, really, which Alistair Burt said. Everything, what he said explains the failure of... It shows how the West has failed even to understand what's going on in Syria, let alone deal with it. It's this sort of extraordinary binary vision between this demonic evil person hell-bent on the murder, gets up every morning, how many children can I murder? Against a much more complicated situation which just to deal with the answer the question, I think that if Hillary Clinton had become president, we would be heading towards World War III, possibly, because she seemed hell-bent on intervening much more in Syria. She wanted talking about no-fly zones and that forth. That would have, and so forth. That would have meant confrontation with Russia. That would have escalated and globalized the conflict. If President-elect Trump is continues the policies he advocated when he was running for office, I think we have a chance of a solution to this conflict quite quickly. I fear that he may be captured by elements in the US deep state which seem determined to continue fight this ghastly and appalling war. But those who really have the humanitarian interests of Syria at heart must hope that President-elect Trump keeps his promise to work with Putin and to work with Iran and to work with Assad to fight the terrorists of ISIL in a coherent battle, rather than try and continue with this misapprehension of what is going on under your, I suppose we better call it, leadership of the Foreign Office, in the early years after 2010, Britain and the United States made a series of fatal errors which have led to the catastrophe which we're now in. First of all, you misunderstood the durability of the Assad regime. You misunderstood the strength of the Syrian army. Above all, and this was your worst mistake, you misunderstood the opposition. You thought that they were a benign collection of liberal Democrats, or such as Tom Brake would feel at home with. In fact, you were dealing with Al-Qaeda, with ISIS, with a series of terrorist groups which have now captured and dominate the opposition, and now, of course, you are going to be confronting an Aleppo. Amazingly, Britain wants to fight alongside Al-Qaeda in Aleppo. It's extraordinary. It has been fighting, or supplying, I'm putting it too strongly there, but supplying, enabling the supply of arms, money and so forth to the militant jihadi groups which are, have destroyed that city already. I've been to the Syria on and off throughout this conflict. I was in Aleppo during the siege at the start of this year. I had a conversation with the very intelligent head of the Chambers of Commerce. He'd been 10 years at MIT, amazingly smart guy, perfect English, very pro-British. And of course, in the government areas, held areas, you notice the mosques adjacent to the churches, you notice the pluralism, you notice the boys and girls holding hands, you notice that there's a curriculum which is totally, school curriculum which is totally recognisable by any Western education authority. And he says, there wasn't an uprising in Aleppo as there were elsewhere in Syria. It didn't happen in 2011. But at the start of 2012, we started to get kidnappings, we started to get assassinations, we asked for help from the government, it wasn't forthcoming. And then on July the 14th, the people in Syria are always good on dates, a convoy rolled in. It came from Turkey. It was supported by the West. It took over the key security points, and eventually Assad did send up some troops, and we have the standoff which has survived to this day. After 3 or 4 weeks, we started to get reports. Who were these people? They had long beards. They came from Afghanistan, from Chechnya, from Algeria, quite a few from Britain, from France, and so forth. This was the International AQ Brigade, militant jihad, sponsored by the West, and particularly by Turkey, had rolled into Aleppo, and they hold it to this day. At last, you were in denial. You guys were in total denial about this for ages. And now, at last, I have noticed that President Obama, in the last few months, does acknowledge that AQ hold Aleppo. My friend Colonel Warren, the man who heads up the PR operation for the US Army, has said so. Mistura acknowledges it. Let's move on now to the contrast between Mosul and Aleppo. Mosul, you have an urban population held by a group of terrorists. A small group of terrorists, a very large urban population held hostage. Exactly the same is the case in eastern Aleppo. Exactly the same. And
I'm sitting there, I know I'm talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you
come and just as many children are being killed in Mosul, but we just don't want to know about it. Just as many atrocities are being committed, we don't want to know about it. Now, by the way, I think we're right to support the operation in Mosul. I do think that ISIS is absolutely a nightmare, and of course it must be confronted in a military way. But the double standard of blaming simply the Assad regime for trying to regain control, the internationally recognized Assad regime for trying to regain control of its own areas from foreign terrorists is simply an hypocrisy and a misunderstanding of the nature of the situation we are confronting. By the way, I'm not. Assad is responsible for many terrible atrocities. I've been around the camps in Jordan. I've talked to the people. It's terrible what his allies have done. I'm not trying to maintain that this is a virtuous individual. I'm simply saying that if you have the humanitarian interest, if you want this terrible war to end, and it's been obvious for some time, we really do have to throw our forces behind Assad. Now, I'm going to just end up. Boris Johnson, we may have noticed, is the current British Foreign Secretary. When he was a Telegraph columnist, he wrote two or three articles, which I read very carefully, saying that we need to deal with Putin and we need to deal with Assad. He walked into King Charles Street, and within days, he'd stood on his head. He was talking about no-fly zones. I mean, I don't know where he gets this from. Presumably, this is Foreign Office briefing. If the Foreign Office is telling the Foreign Secretary that we want no-fly zones, it's telling the British Foreign Secretary we want to risk a war with Russia. Is that what we really want to do? A final point. If we seriously want to sort out Syria, we have two choices. Three choices. We could either allow the Assad to recapture his country, or we can actually do what we tried to do in Iraq and spend hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars taking back Syria from the taking Syria rather from the Assad regime, but do what we're doing so far, which is arranging sort of $10 billion a year of sort of aid and support for the rebels but not getting involved seriously. All we're doing is prolonging the conflict and making it much, much worse. We need some clear thinking from the West. The person at the moment who seems most capable of delivering that, ghastly though he may be for America, is President Trump. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. And I'm very neatly sandwiched between Alistair and Peter, and therefore you're probably going to expect me to disagree with everything that Peter has said. And the first thing I would disagree with him with is that clearly I don't think anyone thought there were Liberal Democrats in Syria. After all, there are very few Liberal Democrats here in the UK, unfortunately. I come here hot foot from FCO questions, where my lot as a Liberal Democrat is to work my way down the order paper and try and get in on the back of a series of supplementaries that other MPs have asked. And I was hoping to ask a question about Syria, but eventually managed to ask a question about Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, the dual national British citizen who is detained in Iran, and just to hear what our government are doing about it. And I suppose as an opposition party, that is the role that we play. We're clearly not in a position to directly influence government policy, but we are in a position to challenge the government when when the opportunity arises. I'm very pleased in the opening remarks that Alistair said that there was nothing new to say on Syria, because he's a very experienced ex-FCO minister, and therefore if he thinks there's nothing new to say, perhaps I'm let off the hook, although of course he did actually go and say new things in his contribution. But so are we facing a regional crisis or a new world war? I think, as other speakers have said, I think to some extent that depends on the position that Donald Trump adopts. Clearly he's in a bit of a dilemma in terms of him wanting to adopt an aggressive stance towards Iran, but it would appear a gentler stance towards Russia, given the role that both of them are playing in Syria present. My starting point when I address the issue of Syria is always really to regret that 3 years ago we did not leave open the opportunity or the possibility within the UK Parliament for the UK government to take military action. I think that was regrettable, and I think we will never know, but what we do know is the number of people who have died since, the number of people who've had to flee Syria, and the number of refugees who are coming to the UK. So we don't know whether a limited military intervention might have made a difference, but we can see the consequences of that. So As I said, our role as an opposition party is really to press the government on points where perhaps we can push the envelope. And so we do often pick up on perhaps some of the things that the Syrian community in the UK are saying needs to be acted on. And so, you know, when there are calls for airstrikes or no-fly zones, it's not just the FCO who are making that point. It is indeed a large number of Syrian organisations here who are making similar points, which we have echoed. Now, for instance, in relation to humanitarian aid drops, when I have raised that in the past, the response from the FCO has been only to be used as a last resort. Well, it would seem to me as though in Aleppo, certainly in relation to medical supplies, if we're not now in a position of last resort, I don't know when we will be. And also on measures which, given that we are in the middle of a propaganda war, I think, with the Russians on this, I think it would be perfectly in order to, as some, again, Syrian organisations have suggested, to have every single military aircraft that of Russia or Syria neatly tracked online for everyone to go and see, so that when you hear that there have been 150 casualties or people killed as a result of barrel bombs, you'll be able to plot the path of the aircraft that was responsible for it. And equally, I suppose you'd want to be transparent and plot our own, perhaps, and make sure that is reflected. Equally, what are the Syrian groups here calling for? So further sanctions, that's something I hope the government will pursue, particularly in relation to Russians who've been actively involved in Syria. A special session of the UN General Assembly, and pushing for more accountability about the war crimes that have been committed there. So as an opposition party, these are the sorts of measures that we will be pressing the government to respond to and hopefully implement. I accept there are real challenges. Peter said the risk of a third world war. I suppose many might have thought there might have been a third world war as a result of Turkey shooting down that Russian plane. So what are the Syrians in the UK saying? Well, they are saying that history is being written. Clearly it is being written in Aleppo. And Aleppo, I think, provides for us perhaps the starting point for a new chapter where perhaps the international community and the coalition of the willing will be willing to respond and perhaps start writing a new history for that beleaguered nation. Or alternatively, Aleppo will provide the final chapter for Syria. And the UK, with its diminished international role post-Brexit, has to use its influence to ensure that it is the former rather than the latter that happens in Aleppo. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I come here as the academic, trying as much as possible to offer perhaps a slightly more cold analysis of the situation in Syria. I do so without any particular overt political association here, and my viewpoint tends to be one of a plague on all your houses in general in Syria. I don't think this is a conflict that anyone comes out of well, and that is very much my starting point. In answering this question of regional crisis or new world war, I would always start by taking a slight step back and saying, well, the new world war notion is a little bit overplayed. It's a bit overblown. And I think that whilst everyone is panicking about the, quite rightly, for different reasons perhaps, the election of Donald Trump, I think it's a myth to suggest that Hillary Clinton would actually have pursued particularly different policies on Syria. I will argue that actually the United States faces quite severe structural constraints in Syria and is not actually that interested, whoever got elected, in intervening further in Syria. And a lot of what was being said by Hillary Clinton was posturing and wishful thinking by the foreign policy community in DC. But actually, if you speak to the military men in DC, the Pentagon, they were very strongly against any kind of further intervention, whoever was elected. And I don't think that's going to change greatly under Trump. To understand those structural constraints, we need to go back and understand how we've got to where we are in Syria. I'm going to talk a little bit about the context of the conflict in Syria, a bit about the regional dimension, and a little bit about the world dimensions. I will conclude that, in now answering to the original question, it's a regional crisis rather than a new world war. When we talk about the context, it's very important to remember that a lot of the changes taking place in the Middle East that have really fed into this conflict and turning it into a regional crisis began before 2011. So much of what has happened in Syria is a knock-on effect of the changes brought about by the 2003 Iraq War. I'm not going back to conspiracy theory, oh, Tony Blair's the worst person in the world and ruined the region, but we do need to understand the massive changes that occurred in the Middle East as a result of that war. Firstly, it greatly diminished American power in the region. We like to talk about a Pax Americana after 1991, after the Gulf War in the region. That was shattered by the failures of Iraq. It showed the limitations of vast military power to achieve political goals. It showed limitations for America's allies, and it showed, showed limitations for the United States themselves. And off the back of that, you get the election of someone like Barack Obama, who says, I do not want to intervene in the Middle East. In fact, I actually want to pull troops out. You get this new mantra in the United States that never existed before of no boots on the ground. That is now a very strong policy that both Clinton and Trump were pushing forward in their election. Special forces, yes, perhaps. You know, Air Force, perhaps. But the idea of deploying large-scale United States troops is off the table now because of the failures of 2003. That's a major structural change. The other major structural change brought about by the Iraq War was the emergence of, or the bringing to the fore of, the Iranian-Saudi rivalry. This had existed since 1979, but Saddam Hussein had conveniently been in the way. Removing that regime and creating a failed state in the centre of the Middle East allowed an arena for those two rivals to actually play out their rivalry. What began in Iraq has then spread across the region. You see it in Syria, in Lebanon, in the Palestinian territories, in Yemen, and so on, a consequence of enabling that rivalry to come to the fore off the back of 2003. The war also, or the circumstance of the war also emboldened other regional powers. Turkey, Qatar, suddenly emerged as this sort of regional actor taking advantage of the changing regional circumstances. Russia as well saw the limitations of US power and saw an opportunity. The reason I say this is when an uprising begins in Syria in 2011, all these regional actors are looking at what's taking place in Syria, not with alarm, not thinking this actually could be a major problem, this could destabilize the region, but they're looking at it as an opportunity. And these various states, for different reasons, move into Syria in different capacities, supporting one side or the other to pursue their regional agendas, not to try to prevent conflict. I would describe the situation as the post-American Middle East. It sounds a bit dramatic, but what I mean by that is saying that sometime between 2008, the election of Barack Obama, and 2011, you see the United States' role in the region structurally diminished. Okay, it's still the most powerful actor, definitely, but it's no longer this sort of hegemon enjoying the United States moment as such that took place after 1991. And in its space, other actors begin to jostle for position. America's allies are far more willing to pursue their own agenda, like Turkey, like Saudi Arabia. Iran is willing to be far more confrontational, to be far more aggressive in its approach. And all of these rivalries are played out inside Syria. And which moves me on to my next point, which is how the Syria conflict very much is a regional conflict. What's also important to remember is that, and again, I want to sort of give Alistair a bit of a break from the accusations he had from Peter a little bit there. The West does get Syria wrong in 2011. They do call for Bashar al-Assad to go in 2011, and they make the assumption that his regime is just like all the others in the Middle East, in Tunisia and in Egypt, and therefore it's going to fall as well in the domino theory. But they make that miscalculation because they don't know the regime. There is a massive knowledge gap about Syria. The State Department has one Syria desk officer in 2011, and they specialise on Syria's foreign policy with regard to Israel and Iraq. No one really knows about the inside of what's going on inside the regime. Okay? But what's interesting is that the people that do know, or the few people that know, like the ambassadors inside Damascus, the British ambassador, the French ambassador, and the American ambassador, all report back to their respective foreign offices and foreign ministries, this regime is not actually on the way out. It's, you know, it's threatened, but it's not on the way out. Be cautious on calling for Assad to go. And a decision is made in the White House by Barack Obama, by his advisors, that no, that's not the case. We must be on the right side of history. The Syrian regime is like these other regimes, so we're going to overrule this professional advice, and we're going to call for him to go. For political reasons, they want to be seen to be doing the right thing. And this sets the West on this course of opposing Bashar al-Assad. The problem is, though, that nothing's changed about those structural facts I talked about before. Barack Obama is not an interventionist president. Quite the opposite. He got elected to keep out of the Middle East. So on the one hand, he's setting off these policies saying, we oppose Bashar al-Assad, he must step down, but I'm not going to do anything about it. And so instead, the United States gives relative free rein to its regional allies to pursue its own policies in Syria. And for the first couple of years, the lead is taken by Qatar and Turkey and later on Saudi Arabia in opposing Bashar al-Assad. And the problem with this structural change to the Middle East is that these states are just not equipped to do this job. They do not have strong institutions. They do not have strong intelligence. They are not good at proxy war. They're not Iran. Iran has been doing this since 1979. They have not. And they get it wrong. They're not able to control the groups they support. A lot of weaponry does go to radicals, although there are moderates, as I would disagree with Pete, there are moderates amongst the opposition, but their ability to control where that weaponry is going is unsuccessful. And a lot of the time, radical groups do emerge, partly as a consequence of these poorly managed proxy warfare being sent by the regional actors. And that prompts the United States to actually step in more and say, okay, fine, you know, you've not done this well, we're going to have to be sucked in and start using the CIA to channel weaponry and training to the right groups. But the cat's out of the bag. The rebels have already, to an extent, seen radical forces amongst them. And so what you have, therefore, is the US playing catch-up. It's reactive because it isn't taking a lead inside Syria. It's responding to what its regional allies are doing in this post-American Middle East. But, of course, the problem is its allies actually don't have the capacity to really do what the United States wanted them to do. The problem, I would say, and I think actually this is really interesting that it was mentioned about the 2013 decision for Obama to not strike against Bashar al-Assad after he used chemical weapons. What's interesting about that is that it's now emerged as this slight myth that that was the turning point, that actually what Obama could have done is ended the war then, he could have intervened and toppled the Assad regime. Other than the fact that that's not what was being proposed, what was being proposed is actually a limited Patriot missile strike as a warning against using chemical weapons. I would argue that that still wouldn't necessarily have changed the circumstances necessarily on the ground, because you still had those structural problems. You still had those external regional players pursuing their agendas and not really listening to what the United States said. Interestingly, even when the US did intervene in Libya, UAE, Qatar still supported their own proxies, irrespective of what the United States asked them or didn't ask them to do. So intervening doesn't necessarily mean you'll rein in your allies. And of course, as I mentioned before, there were already jihadists on the ground in Syria already. So there's really no guarantee whatsoever that that intervention would have actually had the decisive impact that it's subsequently been seen, been suggested would come about. So we need to be cautious about that. But the point I'm trying to make is that for those first couple of years, this really was a regional conflict. And the outside world, the superpowers as such, were playing catch-up, particularly the United States. Which brings us to where we are now. That's obviously shifted recently in 2015 when Russia intervened by sending its air force into Syria to support the Assad regime. Now, what's interesting about Russia's position is that it has evolved its position. It initially viewed Syria through a defensive lens. It was worried that if the Assad regime was toppled, then that would give rise to this precedent of regime change, which Russia's always been opposed to. But again, they've seen that when the United States has not been active, they've recognised the reality of this post-American Middle East and have taken the opportunity to insert themselves into a conflict to further their regional interest and put themselves forward as the regional power inside Syria. However, when people talk about, therefore, we must confront Russia, the reality is that the cat's out the bag already there. The United States is structurally constrained. It does not want to face down Russia. Its military says Syria, quite frankly, is just not important enough. The United States' interest, so they're not willing to face down Russia. So instead what we get is a lot of posturing. We get members of the foreign policy community urging the United States to do more when the reality is they're not going to. We're speaking very much in the language of military confrontation when actually, again, structurally, the US doesn't have an interest in doing so. Instead, one might argue that what is needed is some kind of de-escalatory deal, some kind of de-escalatory rhetoric, and speaking to how you manage to find solutions to the conflict, imaginative solutions rather than just facing one another down. That, however, requires statesmanship. And I fear that the great orange statesman is not going to impress us in this regard. Thank you.